This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and Alex Knight. And we're back after a bit of a hiatus.
Yeah, you could say that.
Well, this is a slightly momentous occasion because we are recording, and I say we, I mean Michael and I, are recording in person for the first time, I believe.
In Alex's intricate recording studio full of wires. And
well, it'll be interesting to see how this goes because I think there's something to be said about having a face-to-face conversation with someone. So I'm not sure if it'll change the dynamic of the show or the sound of the show, but I suspect it will to some degree. So, and hopefully the listeners enjoy it. Well, there's a lot to talk about. Michael, last week, oh my God. I mean, we had the Apple event, obviously. And I think this was the largest Apple event we've had in quite some time with the launch of the new iPhones. We had the iPad Pro, which I did not expect to see in one event. So it's interesting. I know it's been talked to death at this point about sort of the details of the event and what unfolded from that. But it was interesting to see that, like, to me, at least when I watched that event, it didn't feel like, first of all, the quality of the event was better than the WWDC event. And even though it was a long event, I felt like just the pacing seemed better and they seemed more well prepared in it. Even though there was so much information to take in, it just overall, I thought it was a better event.
Yeah. With this event, they kind of showed a much greater level of polish than they've had in the past. Just a lot more rehearsed, less awkward moments. I felt they probably could have had more stage time for women than they did. Notably missing was an Apple Pay update, but I'm hoping we get that closer to the iPad launch.
Yeah, and Apple Pay, it's interesting because I've never tried it because, of course, the two of us are in Canada and Canadian banks don't support it yet. Have you heard anything about that? Have any banks said anything about it?
The rumor is going that they're going to launch it here in November. I guess we'll have to wait and see. Both Tim Cook and the woman in charge of Apple Pay are both going to be talking at separate events next month. So I'm kind of thinking that they might make sort of a impromptu announcement at one of these events where they're just like, oh, by the way, Apple Pay is coming to these countries. There is also rumbling that they're going to start Apple Pay in China soon. I'm not sure exactly which banks will be involved in that. Hopefully we get it soon.
So I'm looking at a tan brown device that's sitting in front of you. Is that a 6S perchance?
Oh, this? Yeah, I think it is.
And you've actually got, looks like, two iPhones in front of you. So what's the deal with that?
I have my old iPhone 6 and my new iPhone 6S. And the iPhone 6S is now completely restored from my iCloud backup and everything. So it's essentially the same phone, but with some key differences. For example, Touch ID now takes far less than a molasses amount of time to unlock the phone. In fact, some people are starting to complain that it's too fast now, so they can't even see the lock screen. To which someone joked, well, hey, that's why they made Apple Watch, because the new Touch ID is so fast, you can't tell the time on your phone anymore.
Well, you know, of course, now with everybody, owning an Apple Watch, we don't need to pull our phones out of our pockets. We shouldn't, right?
No, it's nonsense. You just need the Apple Watch.
And now you have an Apple Watch. How is that going with Watch OS 2? Did you manage to get that on there?
Yeah, I've been running the beta for a while now. I live in crazy beta land, so I've been running iOS 9 and watchOS 2 since June. watchOS 2, I mean, there's not a lot of native apps yet. Developers haven't really released a ton of updates. I've found that the apps are still really slow.
I know people were complaining about the complications and stuff like that, how some data wouldn't automatically get updated until you opened something. For example, like weather data wouldn't necessarily always get updated, and you would have to, you'd see like the two dashes saying that it just couldn't get network data or whatever. So what's the deal with that? Or the basic Apple stuff, does that stuff work better now?
There are still issues. I mean, the thing with watchOS, hardly any of it is really running on the device. A lot of it is data being transmitted between the phone and the watch. So it tends to be really slow despite whatever improvements they make, because it's not Wi-Fi, it's Bluetooth. So Bluetooth has a maximum speed and they can't really get around that, unfortunately. So I can turn to look at my watch, like I can raise my wrist and look at my watch, and often it'll take like kind of a second and a half for things like the weather to snap to what it's supposed to be. Like today, I updated and for whatever reason, my weather app was in Fahrenheit, and it was in Fahrenheit on my watch accordingly because it syncs across. I changed it on the iPhone to Celsius and I looked at my watch and 1.5 seconds go by, it changes to Celsius. So there is still kind of a noticeable lag between changing something on the phone and then the watch kind of gets it.
Do you think that, I mean, obviously Apple is revving the software pretty quickly here, faster than at least I expected it to be, because I mean, the watch itself hasn't been on the market for very long. It launched in what, April? Yeah. And we've had two major OS revisions. So do you suspect that those types of little nitpicks will get ironed out over time with software? Or do you think that's something that we need like a hardware revision for?
I think ultimately there will need to be a hardware revision. You can't fight Bluetooth. So Apple either needs to get the next version of Bluetooth, which does alleviate some of these connection problems. There is actually a new spec for Bluetooth. I think it's Bluetooth 4.2 or 4.3. It's designed for the Internet of Things, and it basically opens Bluetooth up to be as fast as Wi-Fi so that devices can have a zero config connection that allows data to be transferred between them really fast. So if Apple implements that in the next watch and in the iPhone 7, then you'll get that greatly enhanced data transfer rate and the sync time will be instantaneous. But until then, I think we're still going to have to deal with this residual lag, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's too bad. But it sounds like these kind of issues don't seem to be that great of an annoyance, because people seem to still really enjoy using their Apple Watch.
It's not a huge nuisance. I mean, I don't use the apps really. I tend to just use notifications, glances, and soon, hopefully, complications when apps start updating for that. Yeah, the apps are still kind of a mess right now.
Now, hopefully with Overcast 2.0, which is a very, very popular podcast app created by Marco Arment famously, maybe we'll get a native Apple Watch app. Be interesting to see like a top tier app like that, what it could do.
Yeah, I'm really waiting to see someone actually release a really good example. I know Foursquare did just release a watchOS 2 update. I haven't actually taken a look at it yet. Actually, why don't I do that right now? I will do a live demo, which you can't see. It's super fun. I'm opening Foursquare. It's loading. It's loading. Please bring your iPhone nearby to... Oh, okay. Backup problems.
What's happening?
I'm not logged in on Foursquare.
Oh.
Because I restored my phone and obviously it logged me out. Except I'm not logged out. Okay. That was actually pretty fast. I opened Foursquare, it logged me in, and the watch instantly reacted to that. So I'm going to tap on food. 1, 2, 3, 4... And it's given me a list of nearby restaurants. That was actually fairly quick.
That doesn't seem as bad as I would expected.
Tapping on a restaurant, 2 seconds roughly to load the details about the restaurant. It shows a picture, where it is on a map, and 3 tips about it. Then, of course, the handoff is working. It's got a Foursquare icon on the lock screen to take me to this particular restaurant. Seems a lot faster than before, I will say that. So maybe watchOS 2 is a drastic improvement. Like, there haven't been the apps, so I haven't really been able to test it, but this seems promising.
It does indeed. Now, I don't have an Apple Watch yet. I've been holding off. I feel like the hardware is just still in its... both the hardware and the software are still in its early days. So I just feel like maybe I can wait another year. Because the thing is the Apple Watch is one of those things where you ask yourself, or you tell yourself, I don't need this, but I want it.
Yeah. It's definitely one of those things. Like, it does make your life easier. It is really helpful. But is it necessary? No.
Do you find that the watch is distracting you more? I mean, on the one hand, I get the productivity boost, so to speak, by not having to take the phone out to look at basic things. But do you find that it's, you know, how most people today, you know, you can just be on public transit and see how everybody is glued to their smartphones. But with the Apple Watch, do you find that you're glued to your watch?
Not at all. The whole point of the watch is kind of that it shows you important things when you need to see them, and the rest of the time it's just a watch. You don't stare at your watch all day, so why would you stare at the Apple Watch all day? The use case is really just for glancing at relevant pieces of information, like tidbits. Like, you're not reading a novel on the watch, you're not navigating web pages on the watch. You're seeing, oh hey, you have 15 minutes to get to your next meeting, or oh hey, someone texted you. Like, relevant current information, quick little bursts. That's really what it's supposed to be for, which is why I think app developers are kind of having trouble with it. Because for the longest time, the iPhone paradigm has been expose users to as much content as possible, let people just pour through pages and pages and pages of stuff. So it's a completely different type of interaction, which is why I think it's throwing some people for a loop. Like, Facebook hasn't released a watch app yet, probably because they have no idea how to distill Facebook into a really simple contextual experience. I mean, they could probably do Facebook notifications as an app, or like, they did announce that they're bringing Facebook Messenger to watchOS. So that'll work pretty much like the iMessage app. But the actual Facebook app, you're not gonna wanna scroll through your newsfeed on a watch.
No, I mean, the screen real estate, it's too tiny for that kind of thing.
Yeah, which is kind of why the Instagram app fails so spectacularly, because it's like, do you really want to scroll through these tiny stamp-sized photos? No, you want to browse them on your phone where you can see them at their full resolution. So they kind of just rushed into that without really thinking about, is this really something someone's going to look at? And the answer is no. So I think developers haven't really had enough time with it to come up with like really good ideas. It's kind of reminiscent of the iPad, where for the first year or so, apps were basically just big iPhone apps. And then developers started getting ideas. They started understanding the platform. And that's when we really started to see cool stuff.
It almost seems like developers don't really fully understand the platform at this point, because I mean, I'm seeing a lot of apps that don't seem like a good fit for a small interface. I mean, you gave out a perfect example of Instagram. So it almost seems like maybe it's not quite the same as maybe the iPad days, but I do see some similarities there, that it feels like it might take us a couple of years even before we really start seeing the breadth of applications that feel like you just look at them and you go, that makes perfect sense for this device.
Yeah. And I feel it's going to be the same for the Apple TV. Like, not every app is going to work for a 1080p TV. It just isn't. Like, again... Actually, Instagram might work if they do like a whole tile wall of all the photos in your timeline. That might be cool. Or like a screensaver. But Facebook newsfeed, no. Netflix will work, obviously. YouTube, Twitch, all of those will make great TV apps. So like media, games, those will all be perfect. But productivity, that sort of app? I don't know so much. Airbnb's announced that they're making an Apple TV app. I have no idea if that's going to be good or not. Like, will people sit on the couch and browse rental properties? I don't know. E-commerce, on the other hand, that's something that I think will totally work on the TV. What was that company that was on stage? Gilt. They announced they're doing a shopping app for Apple TV. That's totally going to work because you'll be able to swipe through all of these awesome things and then just tap to buy. That is going to be the shopping channel of the 21st century.
I was actually just going to say, because my mom has this obsession with watching things like the shopping channel, but she's never, I don't think she's ever bought anything in the last 20 years. She may have bought one item possibly, but it's one of those things that, like, maybe, you know, that would, it seems like a good fit for that device.
Yeah. Cause you're sitting there and you get to see these large product images across the TV. You can watch videos. Like, it's a format that really lends itself to that sort of thing because you have all of the space to show content where you can be really informational and really visual about these products.
Well, it's also dangerous because we have our credit cards, you know, there we one click buy.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think that one of the reasons why someone like my mom doesn't necessarily buy a lot of products is because of the archaic business model of please call into this phone number and give us your credit card. Like, most people won't do that now.
Yeah.
Those days have come and gone.
Yeah, it's really old. And the fact that they're doing this, like, it is literally going to be a tap. Like, you will press a button and you will have ordered something. Which makes me think that maybe down the road they'll add Touch ID to the Apple TV remote. So then you'll be able to use Apple Pay to buy things. Like, I think this is really going to take off. Like, Amazon, totally expect them to do an Apple TV app. Etsy will probably do an Apple TV app, scrolling through artisanal crafts, you know, that'll be perfect. Pinterest will probably do an Apple TV app, get to see your entire pin board on an HDTV. That'll probably be nice. Like, anything with, like, really visual content I see doing well. But anything textual, like, iBooks isn't going to work. Kindle isn't going to work. Unless,
right,
because
no one's going to read on a TV.
No one's going to do that. So, like, visual content will be king, and that'll be it, really. Like, I think anything really, really visual will succeed, and anything that tries to do anything you have to read will fail horribly.
Michael, nobody reads anymore. Didn't you know? Didn't you get the memo?
Yeah. Well, certainly not on a TV.
Well, speaking of TV, I want to talk a little bit about 4K, and maybe we can just start with the Apple TV, because some people were complaining on Twitter, you know, as they tend to do, about the Apple TV is doomed because it has no 4K. Now, these people are, in my opinion, this is short-sighted, because 4K is not a ubiquitous thing. It's not in most people's homes, and TVs are not something that people replace very often. And if you just look at the price alone of 4K TVs, they're not at that affordability level yet. And I'm not going to spend $3,000 on a, you know, 40 or 45 inch 4K TV when, on top of that, it's not just the hardware, but it's the content isn't there in 4K. There's very little 4K streaming available, and the Blu-ray body or whatever who approves new standards, they're only now finalizing the new UHD spec for Blu-rays. So it's, to quote Steve Jobs, 4K is just a bag of hurt right now.
Oh, absolutely. There's just nothing out there for 4K. Like, YouTube's 4K is a joke. It's ridiculously compressed to the point of being basically as good as 1080p, only slower. Netflix has 4K, but only for certain content and only if you have the bandwidth to support it. So most people are up the creek without a paddle for that one.
Now, Amazon fired back this week with their new TV device that supports 4K. But this is, again, I think one of those perfect examples where people are fixated on specifications.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't get, like, how does this fit into our lives? How is 4K going to make an improvement in our lives? And right now, the reality is that it's not. And we're probably a few years at least away from the point where the hardware ultimately has to get to the point where I walk into a Best Buy and for $800 or $900, I buy a 4K TV.
Yeah.
That's pretty far away at this point.
Plus, I mean, we're only like seven or eight years into HDTV. So we're in the middle of that. And I don't think there's even been a push to switch terrestrial broadcasting to 4K. Like, I don't think that's a thing right now at all. So, because HDTV transition was expensive enough for everybody. Like, every TV station had to update, every news station, every local channel, they all had to update. And that cost a ton of money for new cameras, new equipment. To ask them to do it again so soon, it's not really feasible.
And I still feel like a lot of people today, even though they perhaps have purchased a new TV in the last couple of years, there are plenty of people that I know, including my parents, that have a 1080 capable TV, but they haven't even upgraded their set-top box, their PVR boxes. You know, my dad still stubbornly refuses to pay for upgraded cable to get HD content. So he's got a TV that's capable of doing it, but he's looking at, you know, SD quality video. And I just don't think it's that important to a lot of people.
Yeah. And it'll kind of be the opposite but same problem if people start getting 4K, because all of the content is 1080p. So it's going to get upscaled. And when you upscale 1080p onto a 4K, you've got half the resolution on a 1x resolution screen. So it's going to be blurry as hell, unless you're sitting like 50 feet away from it.
Yeah, I think people like you and me clearly we're in the minority. We're geeks. We tend to live on the bleeding edge of software and hardware, and we like adopting things early. But the reality is, like, most people don't care enough about 4K TV, and they probably don't even really understand it anyways in enough detail that it means anything to them.
I mean, it definitely looks sharper. Like, if people look at a 4K TV, they can tell that, yeah, it looks a lot better. But, I mean, even I'm like, there's no need for this yet, because the reality of the situation is we're at least a decade away from terrestrial 4K broadcasting, at least. And even then, there's going to be this long, lengthy upgrade process where they announce some date in the future where everything will be 4K at that point. And we all know how that went with 1080p. It was long and messy and annoying. So the same thing's going to happen again, because nobody likes change, and telecoms least of all. So it's going to be long and painful and bloody.
Yeah, I mean, I have no plans at all to change my TV. I'm pretty happy with it at this point. You know, this is something I will revisit maybe a couple of years down the line when 4K TV becomes more affordable and there's more content. But I'm one of those people that cares enough about video and audio quality that I still prefer to buy Blu-rays. I don't like physical media. I don't like dealing with it, but I do like the fact that I'm watching an uncompressed video with uncompressed audio. And iTunes, I just don't like buying stuff off of iTunes, because the video, even though it's advertised as 1080p, it still has to be so heavily compressed. For me, on a good TV, on a plasma screen, I can see the difference between a compressed 1080p video and an uncompressed 1080p video. So, you know, and I realize maybe perhaps in the minority, but I just read a report recently that Blu-ray sales are actually still going very, very strong, and they don't show any signs of decline. So people, clearly there's a large enough group of people in the world that care about the quality of Blu-ray. They also, I think more than that, they want to have a physical piece of media that isn't tied to a subscription, where somebody could say, for example, like Netflix frequently content deals expire, and then suddenly their favorite movie is pulled and they are no longer able to watch it, which is incredibly frustrating. That's one of the downsides of streaming. You know, obviously streaming brings many, many benefits and convenience, but still it's not quite there yet either.
Yeah, that, and I mean, bandwidth is still kind of crappy. Telecoms don't offer high enough data caps, that sort of thing. Plus, hard drive space is only big enough. If you start downloading all of these digital movies and shows, you're going to run out of space pretty quick. So I think it's not just that people like owning a physical copy. I think it's that by necessity, you kind of have to a lot for the moment until we get better bandwidth, until we get, I don't want to say higher capacity hard drives. Like, I think ultimately the solution is in the cloud. But
talking about bandwidth, like, for example, with me, I assume this is probably the same for a lot of ISPs, where if you have a cable subscription, they don't cap your data at all. It doesn't get counted. But if you do have something like Netflix, of course, because Netflix is at odds with your telco, who is providing possibly even their own streaming service that they want you to use, they charge you for that. So I have a 500 gigabyte data cap per month, which sounds like a lot, but when you watch that much streaming content on Netflix in HD, and because here's the crux of the issue, because I have 100 megabits per second, Netflix adjusts the video content automatically to match my connection. So it keeps on serving me higher and higher quality video. And therefore, I am consuming more and more data. And I'm constantly finding I'm going over my 500 gig data cap, which sucks because, of course, you know, my ISP is going to be charging me overage charges. So, and I feel like, it, you know, until perhaps there's some kind of regulatory body that we get to the point maybe one day where they say, okay, you know, streaming now is basically in everybody's homes, that we cannot be capping people to 500 gigabytes because it is basically a handicap. You can't use the service.
Yeah. And that's going to become especially true when 4K takes off. Like, we're talking about terabytes a month at that point, and nothing on the planet can support that right now.
I think I saw something like a HD video stream on Netflix consumes something between 3 to 5 gigabytes per hour. That's a lot of data.
Yeah, and 4K is going to be twice that. So up to 10 gigabytes an hour.
So all of you iPhone 6S people that were unfortunate to buy the 16 gig model, you're in for a shock when you start recording 4K video. Let's talk about 4K on the iPhone, because I want to talk about we've been talking about how 4K fits into our lives or will fit into our lives over the next couple of years, but it should be interesting to see how the landscape of smartphones change and impact our lives with 4K video.
I think right now it's just kind of a novelty. A minute of video, according to this, a minute of video recorded on the iPhone 6S at 4K is 375 megabytes. So if you're going to be shooting anything longer than a few minutes, a 16 gigabyte phone is not going to cut it. With Apple still charging the minimum amount of money for a 16 gig phone, like with 16 gigs still as the low tier phone, a lot of people buy it. And Apple will tell you that most people are fine with that, but I really have a hard time believing that.
So if I'm an indie film producer and I want to shoot a movie on my iPhone 6S or 6S Plus, if I were to shoot 2 hours of video, I would need 45 gigabytes of space just for that video, which is insane. So what's your take on the iCloud situation? Because Apple only lowered the price of what they're charging for additional storage to make it slightly more competitive.
Yeah,
now, I don't understand this. Like, they have it in their power to solve this photo problem. I always thought that at the very least, now I'm not averse to paying for storage. I get that, you know, I see the value in it. That's not my problem. My problem is, I think for basic stuff like iCloud backups should not be counted against your paltry 5 gigabytes of storage space. And things like video, with the new iCloud Photos, you can have all of your videos stored in iCloud and not necessarily downloaded locally to the device unless you need to. So why doesn't that stuff just stay in the cloud and download locally when you need it?
Like, the thing is, it never actually removes things. You have optimized iPhone storage as an option, but that just gives you crappier versions of the content. So it saves the space on your phone, but not really a lot. I've never tried it, so I'm not entirely sure, but I don't think it really saves you that much. And I think what it does is it stores crappier versions, and then when you actually access the photo, it sort of temporarily downloads the high-quality version. I don't think it's a huge space saver, especially if we're talking 4K video. With that many gigabytes, even if you've got optimized storage turned on, it's on your device to start with, then it has to upload it. And if you have bad Wi-Fi, like if you're recording somewhere and you need to get that off of your phone as quickly as possible to free up data to shoot more footage, you're probably going to have to sit there for like 30 minutes to an hour, depending on how good the Wi-Fi is. So you're going to have to sit at a Starbucks for a while.
See, the way I've always wanted it to work is that, for example, if I shoot video, be it 4K or whatever, why not just have it upload to iCloud, and then once it's completed, have iOS automatically delete the local copy to free up the space? That way you can always pull it down from the cloud later.
Well, I think the problem with that is they don't want to create a kind of file system situation where it's like you have the stuff on your phone and then you have the stuff that's in the cloud, because that makes it really complicated. The way they have it now is your stuff is your stuff. And maybe on your phone, you have a less optimized version of that file, but you can pull the higher quality version at any time. So you only have one list. You don't have any of this nonsense where it's like, okay, which things are directly on my phone? Okay, which things are on the cloud? iTunes kind of already has that problem at the moment, and it's really frustrating. Like, you have songs that you've purchased, you have songs that you've added to your library from Apple Music, and you have songs that have been matched through iTunes Match. So you've got three different types of songs. And then on top of that, it streams, but also you can download to your phone. So there's a huge amount of differentiation between what a song actually is in the list.
We could probably do an entire episode just about the mess that iTunes is.
Oh yeah, easily. So I can see why they don't want to introduce that anywhere else. So like, your photos are your photos. We're not going to make that extra complicated for you. You just have this list, you have your camera roll with all your moments, and that's it. And in an ideal world where iCloud photo storage is infinite, that would be great, because then they really could do that. It could just be this infinite timeline of every photo you've ever taken. They kind of dropped the ball this year.
It really does feel that way, because we have something like Google, and it's not just one competitor, but it seems like everybody else, all the big players like Amazon and Google, are doing this unlimited photo storage thing. And now even Google Photos, which I think is a better, you know, privacy paranoia aside, I think it's a better solution in many ways, you know, because they allow you to store unlimited photos, although they do limit the megapixels. But I think for the average person, they're solving that issue of my photos are all in one place and they're safe, and I never have to worry about, if I lose this phone, can I recover it? Do I have to make backups to get it? You don't have to worry about that. Not to mention, I mean, I haven't personally tried Google Photos, but I do like the searching capabilities that they've put in there, how you can search for something like snow, and then all the photos, you know, it knows all the photos that have snow on it. And those things, I constantly find myself running into scenarios where I pull open the Photos app on my iPhone and I'm searching for stuff. But of course, the search only works based on the title. And I would assume any metadata associated with that photo. But I don't want to have to do the work of organizing my photos. I'm not going to create photo albums where, like, these are all the photos where I was, you know, that I spent in the summer. These are all the photos from winter. Nobody's going to spend the time to organize their photos like that.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen.
Now, my question is, can this be done? Can we get that kind of functionality locally on that device? I would think especially with the 6S, with the desktop class processing available, they could do something in the software where they could analyze the photos and try to give you that kind of experience. Do you think that's possible?
I think so. I think it's probably something that they are working on. I just think it's a really difficult problem to get it right.
Because Apple doesn't want, of course, they don't want to do what Google's done. They don't want to be processing that stuff on their servers and having that data go to a server, because it seems like they, out of all companies, they try to avoid as much of the privacy pitfalls of, we don't want to see your data. We don't want to know about your data.
Yeah.
But of course, that comes with inconveniences like this, where we're now not getting these super useful features that Google gives us.
Yeah, I think it's going to take some time, but I think they will get to it. And the problem with Google is they need the data to kind of learn what not to do, because right now it's kind of a messy feature. Like, it does a lot of like inconsiderate or accidental mistake sort of things. In that way, it's kind of like Facebook. This is kind of part of a larger problem in tech that we could spend a whole episode talking about, and that's empathetic design. There's a lack of empathetic design in a lot of tech, where basically things are allowed to happen that are insensitive to people because an algorithm decided it was a good idea. For example, Facebook, when they did their year in review thing and it showed somebody photos of their dead child or dead relative. Like, there have been a few cases on Facebook where it does something algorithmically going, oh yeah, I noticed there were a lot of things about this in your year. I'm going to show you these because that's all my algorithm understands how to do. It doesn't understand the context of something really bad happened. So it just kind of blindly does its thing and someone gets upset.
Yeah, that's a great example. I mean, I think I can only assume that companies like Facebook would try to learn from those scenarios. But it does seem like kind of a tone-deaf thing, because you can prevent those things in development. You should be thinking about those kind of things. It almost makes me think, like, are these people even using their own product?
I really don't think so. Like, if you've ever seen a Facebook product demo, it's always these idealized photo sets, like, ooh, we went rock climbing in this national park. Ooh, and then we went white water rafting. Like, who has this life?
Right.
Nobody.
And wasn't it last year, or perhaps it was earlier this year, where they announced that they were not going to heavily compress photo uploads now because they wanted to showcase your beautiful photos? If you look at the average Facebook user's newsfeed, it's full of low-res cat memes. It's not full of these beautiful SLR photos of people
No.
rock climbing and swimming and doing all these sports. Your photos look like garbage half
Yeah.
the time.
And that's why Facebook Paper was such a beautiful catastrophe. And the Facebook Android home screen thing that they made, I think it was called Facebook Hello or something like that. Like, it was just an utter failure because they're expecting to have these beautiful full screen images of all these things. And you know what I got when I tried it? Memes.
Pictures
memes.
Of people's food, what they had for lunch.
Yeah. It's just the worst garbage that you don't want to see splashed across your phone screen.
Especially not the lock screen, like on Android, with that thing where they would replace the Android
Yeah.
launcher with the Facebook
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you unlock your phone and the first thing you see is a crappy blurry meme. Nobody wants that. And it's just another example of this ridiculous tone-deaf design where it's like, oh, of course people will have photos like this. Not all the time. You need to design for the lowest common denominator. You need to design for the times where people don't want to see photos of things because they're too upsetting. They might have them to remember someday, but if it's still raw in their minds, they don't want to see those photos. They want to keep them, but they don't want to see them right now. Yeah, it's a difficult problem, but developers really, really need to get this right, because as we start putting more of our lives into our technology, this is going to keep happening more and more until somebody does something about it.
So what else? We should probably move on. So let's kind of shift gears, I think, a little bit to something I know we've talked about in the past. We've talked about gaming. For any of you who have been listening to the show since we relaunched it, we've kind of shifted gears in terms of the topics that we tend to cover. And the tech stuff is something that we still continue to cover, although, you know, at least we try to make an effort to some sort of come at it at a different angle, I guess, than a lot of other shows. But I want to talk a little bit about some gaming stuff that's been happening lately, like the big new Destiny, the Taken King launch, which I know has a lot of people talking about, and something that I've talked about only briefly in the past because I did try the game at launch and I kind of gave up on it. And now, of course, I've gone in and started over. I've started a brand new character now that Nolan North is voicing that robot character, whatever its name is. But anyways, obviously the game seems like it's like a brand new game. It feels that way. They've changed so many fundamental things with the 2.0 patch. I'm not too far into it. It does feel like things are moving along a little bit easier. I don't feel like I'm getting stuck leveling up, and I don't have the Taken King expansions yet, but from everything I've read and everything I've heard from people that are playing it, they said this is the game that should have come out last year. Now, one thing I haven't really heard anyone talk about, and this is something I wanted to mention, is that I really feel like they could have held back Destiny for another year, but even if they had, I really don't feel that they would have been able to get something anywhere close to where it is now without people trying it and without getting that user feedback. That this is one of those types of games where you have it is a multiplayer game for the most part. It requires an internet connection. You do have single player story mode, but largely the core of the game requires an internet connection. And I don't feel like, because of the MMO elements, I really don't feel like they would have been able to tweak it properly without getting a huge user base playing it. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, they've basically had a year. Like, in interviews, they talked to Luke Smith, the lead designer for Destiny now, and they released Vanilla already working on Taken King. So they were basically watching and poring over all the data and reading all the comments on the Destiny subreddit. I mean, they even recruited the mod of the Destiny subreddit to become a new community manager at Bungie, which was pretty cool. So they're definitely listening. They're definitely paying attention. And it really shows. Taken King is a massive leap forward. And yeah, it really is the game that Destiny needs to be. Just this week, we found that a heroic daily mission has a secret component that allows you to get an exotic weapon that we'd never heard of. Like, it was completely new. They just found it randomly. Bungie came out and said, "Oh, hey, you found it. Cool." There's a lot more where that came from. So the thing about Taken King is, like, you start with the first layer, the story missions, then you get to the more in-depth quest stuff, and then the raid, which just came out. And now this, there's just so much going on. There's so much content. There's almost too much to do, which is an awesome problem for this game, because the first year, people just kind of ran out of things to do. So the fact that there's so much and we haven't even found all of it, there's like secret things that require skill and investigation and a little bit of curiosity. It's great. Like, this feels like the old Bungie. This feels like Halo. I mean, it's not Halo. It's arguably cooler than Halo. But, oh boy, all the Halo fanboys are going to kill me now. But no, it's really cool. And I'm just having a blast playing it. It's been really fun the past few weeks.
They increased the level cap, didn't they?
Yeah, the new level cap is level 40, but level is only half of it. There's also your light level, which is now at a cap of 310, up from the previous 170, which is the readjusted value for year one. Before it was much higher, but they like rebalanced all of the numbers to account for Taken King.
Now, overall, it seems like a much more well-balanced game. And one of the things that piqued my interest when I was reading into it was that some of the rare items and difficult drops that were extremely difficult to get now are much less difficult to get. Is that true?
Well, they've done a number of things. The exotic items, which are the rarest items in the game, to the point where you can only use one exotic weapon at a time and one exotic armor piece at a time. A lot of those they've made into quests that you have to find and unlock, like that secret one that we just found this week. There's only a very limited set of them that are available for sale from Xur, which is this alien guy that shows up every weekend where you can buy exotics for strange coins, which is a random inventory item thing that you can get.
I don't think I have any at such a low level. Like, how do you get those coins?
They randomly drop.
Is that when you, like, when you defeat a boss or something? Or
yeah, they can drop in all kinds of scenarios. It used to be that you would do the heroic weekly mission, and that would guarantee you 9 strange coins if you completed it at its highest difficulty level. But they've done away with that, and they now have a heroic daily and a Vanguard heroic strike playlist. So there's basically a bunch of activities. They've gotten rid of guaranteed strange coins, but they've increased the drop rate of them. They also randomly award them to you if you complete bounties or reach a new allegiance rank with a faction. So, like, just this week, last weekend, I used up all of my coins. This weekend, after just playing the game normally, I have 31 coins. So I wasn't even trying to get them, and I just got them. So now I have enough to actually buy stuff, which is great.
I feel more confidence in the longevity of this game. It feels like we have, at this point now, a game that is going to be around for years that people are going to be super happy with. There's always going to be stuff to do. It's more enjoyable to play.
I mean, they've always said they have a 10-year plan for Destiny.
That seems a bit ambitious.
They've said they don't know exactly what that plan is. They're making it up as they go along, sort of thing. Like, they've guaranteed 10 years of games in their contract with Activision. Yeah, this is a huge step forward. And if they keep this pace up, supposedly the next expansion will be a DLC chapter that comes out sometime in Q2 of next year, maybe? I don't know. It depends how much more content there is in Taken King. Nobody's done all of it. There's still a bunch undiscovered. For example, there is an exotic fusion rifle called Sleeper Simulant, which fires a laser that bounces off of walls up to a maximum of 7 times. So basically, bouncy laser death ray.
Thank you for that eloquent description.
Yeah, it's a great description. Nobody has figured out how to get it. There were some initial clues. These random legendary items would drop, and they seem to be connected to it. No one has figured out how to get to the next step in order to actually get the weapon. So there's actually an entire subreddit that broke off of the Destiny subreddit dedicated to figuring out how to get it. That's how crazy the mysteries in this game are now. And like that other exotic I was telling you about, it's an exotic sniper rifle. The way you get it is when you're playing the mission normally, instead of going the route you're supposed to go, you have to turn left and go into this other area. And then that will trigger an event that takes you up to a ship. And then you have 10 minutes to kill everything on the ship, culminating in a giant boss fight at the end. And then if you manage to get through all of that, you get the weapon. So it's a... somebody on Reddit referred to it as a Star Fox ending.
I don't get the reference. I've never played it.
So in Star Fox, if you complete a certain objective or do something in a certain amount of time, it'll unlock an alternate level. So, like, the story will basically completely change and go off into a tangent. So it's kind of like that, where they've somehow inserted these, like, really special secret things where if you do a particular thing, it'll unlock a completely new path and allow you to obtain previously unobtainable reward. Everybody's really paranoid now and thinks there's secrets everywhere, which is awesome.
The one thing that I still find frustrating is that there isn't a lot of in-game help in terms of, like, all the intricate details about the game. And I had to go elsewhere, you know, read wikis, read blog articles. There are a couple people that wrote some articles sort of just giving you a high-level summary about how the game worked. And I learned more about the game from those articles than I did from actually playing the game, which frustrates me.
Yeah. It's something they could do a lot better. For example, there are these cards you can get by playing the game called Grimoire cards, and they reveal a lot about the lore of the universe, but you can only read them through the Destiny smartphone app.
Yes.
Or on Bungie.net. There is no in-game Grimoire reader, which is really frustrating. But I think part of the problem is they still have to support Xbox 360 and PS3. I think when they get to Destiny 2 and they're only on the current gen platform, that's when we'll see features that are, like, really crazy. Like, that's when I think we'll see bigger maps, possibly open world maps that are more like an MMO, a Grimoire card reader, a ton of stuff that wouldn't have been possible because they had to take into account the old platforms. They've even said a number of times, like, one of the things people always complain about in Destiny is vault space. Initially, the vault was quite small, so you couldn't store a lot of weapons or armor. And they basically said the reason for that was the memory on the old platforms wasn't enough to actually store that much data.
But they fixed that, didn't they?
Well, they sort of fixed it. First, they fixed it by... I don't remember exactly what they did the first time, but they did some sort of compromise tweak where they were able to increase the number of slots by like 5 or 10 by limiting something else. But then in Taken King in the 2.0 patch, they were able to increase it further because what they did was certain items they basically took out of the inventory entirely and put them into a collection vendor, which... I guess is a totally different space. So on the old consoles, it works because you're only viewing one set of things at a time, so it doesn't run out of memory. So that's emblems and shaders, which are purely cosmetic items. So now you can actually just go to a kiosk and see all of the ones you've managed to collect.
So you think that when we get to Destiny 2, the sequel, that they'll be able to maybe accomplish what they wanted to do initially, but couldn't because of that? They were tied to these legacy platforms, essentially.
Yeah, they've basically gone on record as saying, like, there are all kinds of things we wanted to do, but we weren't able to do, and we want to provide the same experience to people playing on older platforms. Like, that's in writing in numerous interviews. So it basically says to me, like, we have much grander plans for this game. We want the game to be able to do so much more. But I really think it's impressive they managed to fit as much as they have and still support the old consoles. Like, the new playable area, the Dreadnought, is massive, just massive scale. Just these huge expansive rooms and corridors. I guess they kind of trick you because a lot of it's like long hallways, but yeah, it just feels really epic in scale. And the same is true for a lot of the older map areas as well. It's impressive, but I think they can definitely go a lot further than they've been able to. I think an expansion probably isn't going to cut it, because expansions are DLC on an existing SKU. So they're going to have to make an entirely new SKU in order to say, this is only available on PS4 and Xbox One. I don't know. I think realistically, we might see it in 2017. 2016, obviously, we'll have two DLC expansion chapters. Then we go into Destiny Year 3. I think that might be the year where we actually see Destiny 2 happen. They might release a stopgap expansion chapter that lays the groundwork for it.
That sounds reasonable, because we're now, what, into year two of the new generation consoles? PS4, Xbox launched 2 years ago in October, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, if they've been working on Taken King since Destiny came out, or even before then, chances are they've also got a team working on the proper next gen sequel. Well, I don't want to call it a sequel, because it won't really be a sequel. It'll be more like a heavier duty expansion that basically changes everything. Like, Taken King changed everything, but this will change everything all over again, especially if they like add a ton of next gen only stuff. Like, if they make bigger maps that are like open world, the entire scale of gameplay will change. Like, right now the maps are kind of medium to small. If they increase that size, if they increase that scope, we could get some really killer gameplay where you're just engaged in these massive land battles with enemies. They can fit more enemies on screen. They can just do things they wouldn't have been able to do before if they're supporting both platforms. I think feasibly 2017 might make sense. Otherwise, they might delay it a bit. It probably won't be the start of 2017. They'll probably announce it at E3 and it releases in the winter of 2017, kind of like they did with Taken King. And throughout the year, they just announce more and more info about it. That should definitely be something to look forward to, because our accounts will transfer over, because it's like an MMO. So all of your characters will carry over to the new game, all of your items, all of your stuff. It'll all still be there when you log into the new game. And obviously the level cap will go up, like any MMO.
The one thing that I don't like, and it has nothing to do with the game itself, but I like reading release notes, and I noticed that Destiny is the only game on my PS4 where when it gets a patch update, I go to look at the history of changes, and all it says, please go to Bungie.net to read the release notes.
Yeah, the thing with that is they do publish really detailed release notes. I don't know why they don't do it on the console, but they must have their reasons.
It seems like, I mean, they don't just release a list of fixes or changes. They do like in-depth blog posts, like,
oh, yeah,
here's the rationale for why we did what we did, and here's what we learned. You can't really have a blog post in the release notes on the PS4 itself.
Especially when they do the periodic weapon rebalance patches, where it's like, we nerfed this, we buffed this, here's why, we noticed players were doing these certain things and they were using these weapons too much, and people were exploiting this in PvP, so we decided to change this over here and do that. You just can't get that fidelity on the little PS4 changelog thing.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I think that pretty much covers it for the past few weeks, at least.
Well, on that note,
thank you for listening to another episode of The Impromptu. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to leave a rating on iTunes and let your friends know about us. Detailed show notes for each episode are available on our website at theimpromptu.net. You can follow the show on Twitter at theimpromptu, as well as our hosts individually at Zen Impulse for Michael Norton and at Zero Distraction for Alex Knight. As we are entirely listener supported, you can donate to us at theimpromptu.net/donate. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth as well as equipment upgrades to uphold the highest level of audio quality you've come to expect. We really do appreciate your support, and we look forward to seeing you next time.